Elephants. They're big and wrinkly and slightly terrifying. A great big bull elephant inspires awe and fear. They're the only land creatures that really truly approach the great dinosaurs in scale. On the other hand, a baby Indian elephant can be quite adorably lovely. Tammy Matson is an Australian zoologist who got the African bug early on and has lived and worked close to elephants for most of her adult life. Tammy specialises in human-elephant conflict. And I now know that human-elephant conflict is on the rise all over the world. More and more elephants are crashing into human settlements in Africa and India, looking for water and food. And when a group of hungry and thirsty elephants comes to your home, you know all about it. But it turns out that the Africans have come up with some clever solutions to keep the big grey beasts at a distance from human settlement without harming them. But Tammy now says the biggest threat to elephant populations, and rhino populations too, is from poaching, which has made a big comeback. Since Tammy Matson was last on the program, way back in 2006, she's gotten married, she's had a kid, she's moved to Singapore, and from there Tammy has been able to track the illegal trade in ivory and in rhino horn powder. And the reason for this high demand in rhino horn powder? Well, it's served at parties as a high-prestige hangover cure. And by the way, it doesn't work. Tammy Matson's new book is called Planet Elephant. Hi, Tammy. You've been busy since I last saw you.
I have. I've done a few things, yeah.
Lovely to have you back.
Thank you.
I think we should start, before we talk about any of this, about the joy of elephants. Mm. I think elephants, they make you kind of giddy when you look at them and see them. I've never seen them in the wild, obviously, like you have. What kind of pleasure do they bring to what inspires a love of elephants in you?
Well, if you've ever spent any time sitting with baby elephants while they're in the mud, having a mud bath and playing with each other, it's just like watching human toddlers playing around with each other. They are hilarious. They whack each other. They throw mud at each other. If you're in the way, you're going to get mud in your face as well. You know what I love about that? It's they are so happy. I've seen even the orphans of poaching who have been traumatised in their lives, just so in the moment and so happy, just enjoying a good old mud bath. And I tell you what, when you're in that situation, you just feel like jumping in there with them.
A previous guest on this program once told me that elephants grieve over dead ones. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen it personally, but you hear about it constantly in this profession. You know, the more time you spend with elephants, the more respect you have for them. And, I really think they show us the best side of ourselves in so many ways. And people that work with them, like Daphne Sheldrick in Kenya, for example, who's been working on them for 40, 50 years, she believes that elephants can read our hearts. So, I mean, to her, elephants are a better version of us than we are.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, is that a bit new agey, though? I mean, because these are also creatures that are prone to rage like we are and prone to, you know, wanting what they want. So, I mean, they're not kind of dolphins, are they? It's not quite right to see them that way, is it?
I think the level of intellect is, yeah, absolutely right up there with dolphins. I think chimpanzees and dolphins and elephants are all probably much more intelligent than we realise and much more emotionally intelligent than many of us, actually. And, someone like Daphne Sheldrick, she's a realist as well. You know, she knows the other side of elephants. She knows how much destruction they cause, but she still loves them. You know, they're like her family.
On your first trip to Africa, you were just shy of 16 years old. What took you there?
Yeah, I was such a youngster. I'd grown up in North Queensland, surrounded by animals, but obviously never been anywhere like Africa. And then my dad wanted to go on safari, and I was the eldest child, so lucky me, I got to go over there. Poor mum was left behind with two younger kids to look after, and it just changed my life. It was after that there was no going back for me.
Why did it make such a powerful impact?
Africa gets under your skin, and it's an addiction, and. You know, whether you go there as a 15-year-old or a 25-year-old or as a 60-year-old for the first time, there's a very, very good chance that you will get this bug, as I call it, the Africa bug. And, if you love animals, if you love wilderness, there is something about, you know, even places like Kenya, where I went for the first time recently, it feels like you're in the cradle of humankind. It's really primitive.
You stayed at a place called Humani when you went there, and you've been back many times, and that's a large part of your book. Tell me about Humani, what kind of a place that is.
Well, Humani is part of the Savi Valley Conservancy. So it's originally was a cattle cattle farmland, and back in the early 90s they converted it into a wildlife conservancy. So they dropped all the fences between the cattle farms and turned it into a wildlife area. They've really been struggling. They bought a lot of elephants and rhinos in, and wildlife really built up for a long time. But you know, since the year 2000 and the political instability that's been in Zimbabwe, they've really been struggling to keep the wildlife alive.
When you were there in this would have been, I don't know, the early 90s or thereabouts, would it have been?
Thereabouts. 93.
As a 15-year-old girl, what decisions did you make while you were there? Did you want to come back as soon as possible?
Yeah, definitely. That was the very strange thing about Africa. I mean, I had my life sort of plotted out. I was going to be a lawyer, you know. I'd enrolled in university, and I had grand plans for my future. But Africa really changed that, and I just developed this really strong passion from this early age, and I knew that I was going to be a wildlife conservationist at that point. And it's been 20 years now, so nothing has changed really.
So when you got back, you had to quit your law degree and do science instead.
I never even made it to the law degree. I went back in my gap year at the age of 17, and I'd been accepted into law at the University of Queensland, and then I just came back and I said, nope, I'm not doing that, and switched over to science with none of the prerequisites of science. I was much more of an English drama art type of thinking person, so I had to go and, you know, do subjects that I'd never done before. But I got there in the end, eventually, and became a zoologist.
So then you went to Namibia. Why Namibia? What took you there?
Well, the year 2000, if anyone remembers, was a pretty bad year for Zimbabwe, and I had been given an Australian government scholarship to study impalas, which is one of the most common African antelope, the species that everything eats, basically, from lions to leopards to wild dogs. And then in the year
chicken of Southwest Africa, is it?
The chickens of Southwest Africa, yeah. It was basically fast food for African predators, and but great species to work on. Unfortunately, my PhD scholarship and the university that I was with, the University of Queensland, wouldn't allow me to stay in Zimbabwe. It was going to be too dicey to be there. You know, there was war veterans crawling all over the Sabi Valley Conservancy. It had become quite a dangerous place that year, Zimbabwe, and so I had to really work out a plan. And I knew that there was another subspecies of impala that lived in Namibia, which is this, you know, arid desert country I knew nothing about. I'd never been there, on the other side of Africa. So I got in a Chico Golf with a friend, and we headed across the Kalahari through dodging donkeys all the way, and finally made it to Etosha National Park, and that's where I found this black-faced impala that almost nothing was known about, that was actually quite threatened at the time, and ended up doing my PhD on them instead.
What's the country like there?
Wild and extreme. It's probably one of the hardest places I've ever lived.
It's a lot of desert there, isn't there?
It's all desert dunes. It's all orange and blue skies and the Skeleton Coast. You know, it's the Namib Desert. It's
a bit like the Kimberley then, is it, in some ways?
Yeah.
Like red earth and desert, in the hinterland anyway, beyond the tropics.
There are similarities. Probably the biggest difference is the fact that you get, you know, elephants and lions living in this desert environment as well. But it has that same sense of wildness. And the wonderful indigenous people that inhabit those areas are just how they live out there with virtually no water is just incredible.
How did you become aware of this conflict in Africa?
By accident, as a lot of my things in life have come to be. I went up to Bushmanland, particularly an area called the Ninai Conservancy, and it's in the northeast of Namibia, just south of the Caprivi Strip, bordering Botswana. And this is where the sand bushmen live in Namibia. And I really just fell in love with the place and the people. And I said to the chief of the bushmen, you know, could you use a zoologist? I'd been working on impala then for 6 years, and I was ready for a change. And he said, well, our big problem is elephants. And, you know, it was a story I was going to hear, you know, again and again in different places I would work across Africa and Asia after that. But that was my first experience of actually working on human-elephant conflict with, you know, on the ground with people and working out how to try to find some local solutions that actually work to reduce the problem.
What was the problem?
Well, elephants in Bushmanland, the issue was all about water. Namibia being so dry, you know, water is like gold. So, you know, the elephants were coming in and destroying the water holes, and people needed to drink water as well. So they were killing people as well. It was a really big problem. And to the Bushmen, they wanted that sorted out. Actually, it wouldn't have been a problem except for the fact that boreholes had been drilled in the area. There never used to be boreholes. So now the bushmen were living a more sedentary life. There was more water available for the elephants. It was drawing them in from Botswana and the northeast of Namibia. So with all that, you know, changes, it had brought this human-elephant conflict. But interestingly, one of the best solutions in that area has been simply to move the waterholes further away from villages. And so that's what we started doing, not so much myself, but the government personnel in that area and volunteer groups came in and just started building water holes further away from villages. And that did seem to help quite a lot to reduce the problem.
Of course, yeah. And the other solution they came up with involved chilies, which I love. Tell me about this. This is quite ingenious.
Chilies are working incredibly well across Africa. There's a group called the Elephant Pepper Development Trust that started this idea, and it's just taken off. And you basically grow some chilies, and you mix them in with some dried elephant dung, put it into a container, dry it, and then you put these dried elephant chili bricks around your crop, and put a hot coal on top, and the smoke is what actually deters the elephants. So
they don't like chili smoke. I don't suppose many of us do they, anyway, because it makes your eyes sting, doesn't it?
So. That's right, they don't. And African elephants are really deterred by this idea of using chilies. And they've also used, you know, they mix chili substances with oil, and they put it on fences around crops. But the great thing about that is it also provides a cash crop for people. So actually, it does a lot for people living in poverty to be able to not only deter the elephants that are causing the problem, but also to make some money at the same time.
Tell me, you said you got the African bug, and there was one moment, though, when it almost left you. You had a bit of a long, dark night of the soul in the Namibian desert. You thought about giving it away. Tell me about that night.
It was something to do with being 29, I think. I was at a stage in my life where I'd been working in Africa for so long and out in the bush, and it was a dark night in Namibia, and they are dark nights out in the desert when you're on your own. And it was one of those
incredibly still, isn't it?
Yeah. Still and quiet, and you can hear everything. And on this particular night, I was on a little tiny tent by myself on the ground, and along came a bull elephant. And I knew it was an elephant straight away because I was in this very rocky environment. I could hear the crunching of his footsteps as he stepped towards me. And then he was joined by a friend.
You're lying in bed hearing this, are you?
I'm lying on a swag on the floor in a zipped up tiny little pup tent on the floor.
You can't see anything.
See a thing.
But you're hearing this, foot padding, are you?
I can just hear this big bull elephant coming towards me. And as a zoologist, I knew exactly what it was. But I couldn't get out because I knew that if I got out, he would probably get a fright. But I could hear him right beside my tent. I mean, literally right beside my tent. And this is a 6-ton elephant bull.
If he stepped on your tent?
That's exactly it. And that's what I was thinking. And I was thinking, okay, I just have to take some deep breaths here and just let him do what he's going to do. And so, of course, then he decided to fart right above my tent. So now he's standing above me, farting. And one of the other, either him or the other bull went and started scratching his bum right next to the tent on the nearest mapani tree. And I tell you what, Richard, that was the point where I just said, it's time for me to give it all up and get a real job.
Well, then you did get a job. The World Wildlife Fund offered you a job in Sydney. Could anything you learned in the bush prepare you for office politics in life in the big city, Tammy, I wonder?
I was very daunted, I must admit, coming back to Australia after so long in Africa, particularly being a Queensland girl and moving to the big city, Sydney. And I must admit, I would have been much more comfortable out in the desert with a scarab beetle for company than, on the 13th floor of a high-rise in Sydney. But it was a great experience. I worked for WWF for a couple of years running their national species program. And I learned a great deal about the problems facing Australian wildlife. And it was a great experience to be able to do that because we've got really big problems here as well. So although my passions have always lain with African wildlife and particularly in developing countries, it was great to be able to start spreading the word about what we can do in Australia to stop species like the lesser bilby and the crescent nail-tailed wallaby going extinct. They're already gone, but stopping any more disappearing.
The experience with the farting elephant meant you thought popped into your mind, maybe it is time I got married and maybe had kids down the track. Tell me how you met the man who was to become your husband, Andy.
Yeah, that's right. Life takes mysterious turns. So although I had resisted returning to normal life and getting a paid job, I finally ended up back in Sydney. And on my first week in the job, I met the man who had become my husband, Andy Ridley, who's the CEO of Earth Hour. And he was at that stage head of the communications program for WWF Australia. And that was, in fact, I think it was just a few months before the very first Earth Hour ever happened in Sydney. So it was long before. I mean, it's obviously grown into an astronomical event now around the world, with enormous growth in particularly in Asia and South America, those sort of places. But that was back in the early days. So we've now done many, many Earth Hours behind us, and we've moved into a different world. And actually, it was because of Earth Hour that we moved to Singapore about a year ago.
But if he was going to be your husband, he was going to have to like Africa. How did he like Africa when you took him there for the first time?
Well, thankfully he liked it, because if he didn't like it, we would have had trouble on our hands. It wasn't going to work. But he did. He really, you know, I remember the look on his face when he saw his first lion. It was late at night in Hwange National Park in Zimbabwe, and the guide pulled up right alongside a big male lion, and this lion was roaring right beside the vehicle. And I could see Andy, who was in an open vehicle a metre away from this lion, and his face was just, you know, it, just pure magic, you know. And he actually loves it as much as I do. So we go back together as much as we can now.
Where did he propose to you?
And this is going to make some people sick, because it's a very good, this is probably the best engagement story you're ever going to hear. His first trip to Africa, shortly after he saw his first lion, we were in somewhere at the confluence of the Zambezi and the Chobe rivers, which is really elephant country. There's no greater elephant population in the world there. And he tricked me by saying that there was a sitatunga, which is a rare antelope in Africa that I've never seen, that I really want to see, on an island nearby. So we jumped into the boat and off we went to look for this sitatunga. And as we were tracking this sitatunga, this supposed sitatunga through the bush, I could only see elephant tracks and hippo tracks. And then suddenly there was a clearing in this island, and here's all the white tablecloths over the tables and the champagne,
oh,
and a beautiful spread. And then he got down on one knee as the hippos honked in the background. It was fantastic. So, yeah, the wedding was never going to top the engagement after that. It was fantastic.
How were you with that? You must have been overcome.
I was. You really couldn't get a better engagement for a girl like me, to be quite honest. He knew what to do. it was magical. And it was really, for us, the start of a much bigger adventure. You know, obviously child rearing and, you know, travelling and continuing to do conservation work, both of us together.
In 2008, you went to Assam in India, northern India, near the Himalayas, isn't it?
Yeah.
Tell me about you were there to sort of see what human-elephant conflict was like there. What was the nature of the conflict there like?
You know, Assam is a crazy place. The human-elephant conflict up there is much more intense than what you see in southern Africa, for example. It's a war. It's a war. So every night you go out and people are there in the hundreds during the rice harvest season, which is several months every year, and they've got burning spears and torches, and they're screaming at these elephants to get out of their crops, because obviously they rely on these crops. You know, this is all they've got. They're very poor. But there's about 5,000 elephants left up in that part of the world, but they are just living in an absolute war zone, because most of their habitat's been cleared and they don't have any choice but to come out of the areas that used to be, you know, forest, but are now covered in rice paddies and tea gardens and towns. And, you know, in that part of the world, elephants regularly get hit by trains. I mean, can you imagine?
Oh, my God.
They get caught up in low-hanging power lines and electrocuted. I mean, it's shocking. And you lose several at a go, because, you know, when one elephant is electrocuted, the others will come in to help it, then you know, you get a mass death. And not long ago, there was a mass poisoning there as well in retaliation for human deaths caused by elephants. So it's a real struggle up there. But the root cause of that problem, and across most of Asia really, is habitat loss. You know, we've just cleared so much of their habitat.
How much of the forests in Assam have been lost?
I think it's about 2/3 were lost even before I started working there.
So that means elephants are coming into the rice paddies that are now in these places that were once forest. And do they like eating?
Yeah, they love it. They love rice paddy. It's fantastic food for them. They like most of the things that we like, actually. I mean, that's really, we're competitors in that environment.
What are they you write that they come crashing into the villages there, looking for food and stuff to drink. What do they drink once they
get
there?
Yes, well, actually, some of the elephants up there are slightly alcoholics, and they like the rice beer that the locals brew as well. So if they come upon, you know, a village where there's some nice fresh rice beer, that they'll go straight in there and have a drink. And, of course, can you imagine when there's drunken people and drunken elephants running around in the bush at night? And it's not pretty, Richard.
I know, I'm trying not to laugh because it's obviously not funny, but the whole idea of a pack of drunken elephant louts trampling through a village must be pretty quite terrifying for the locals. And of course, but then they respond in this way, which is to form a kind of, you know, Frankenstein mob with what, like torches and burning spears to it's so different from Africa, where one lone villager, one bushman can just fend off an elephant without too much trouble. Why is there this kind of this level of response? What the difference in response in India as opposed to Africa?
I think it's got perhaps to do with the fact that so many people are getting killed, and you know it's retaliation to some extent. You know, because people are so desperate there, and I mean, I can see both sides of the story, because you feel for these poor people, because I've met the widows of the conflict who are living in a situation where they've got to raise children on their own with no income after their husband's been killed. And, you know, I met one widow whose children still sleep up in a tree because they're scared to sleep in the house, which is where their father was dragged out one night by an elephant.
What do you mean dragged out? I thought they would just trample on people.
Yeah, well, he came out to defend, I guess the elephant was coming in to take some of the grain that was in the silo next to the house, or maybe it was for rice beer or something like that, and he came out to defend his family, and he was at the entrance of the hut, and the elephant was right there. I mean, we're talking about very close proximity. These elephants are 1 or 2 metres away from people, and of course all the elephant had to do was reach out and pull him out and dragged him away.
What, with the trunk?
And
then what would the elephant do? How would it kill?
I think in that situation he was crushed, so he was literally, I mean, elephant's trunk has got so many muscles in it. You could crush it just with a trunk. But I think a lot of the time there is a sort of a kneeling response. To be honest, I try not to think too much about that side of things. I think it's unfortunately the statistics are really not good for the number of people that get killed by elephants. It's over 100 in India every year.
But of course, as you say, they're just animals looking to stay alive, aren't they? Yeah. Their habitat's been destroyed. They're looking for food and drink.
Yeah, they're looking for food and drink. That's exactly right. So it's a tough situation, you know. How do you find that balance? And that's why we're really trying to find solutions like chilies, for example, which are great, which help people to coexist in harmony with elephants. And Asia is a tough situation. In some ways, it's easier in Africa because they've got more space and not as many people, not as dense, you know. So you get countries like Botswana that, you know, there's 130,000 elephants in Botswana. That's the biggest population of any elephant anywhere in the world. And there is human-elephant conflict there, but it's nowhere near on the intense scale that you get in India, because there's less people there.
You were there with a WWF crew to sort of film these moments of conflict between humans and elephants. And one night you fell asleep in the vehicle when you got bogged in a rice paddy. How were you woken up after you fell asleep that night?
That was one of my weirder waking up moments, and I've had a few in my life. And I just literally, I was so tired. It was about midnight or something. We'd got bogged in a rice paddy, and we'd been filming since very early that morning, and we were still surrounded by this war. You could hear the firecrackers going off, which sound like gunshots that the villagers used to keep the elephants away. And suddenly I woke up, and I felt the car jolt forward. I was like, what the hell? Did I dream that, or did that really happen? And then it jolted again, and I sat up, bolt upright, and looked behind me, and there's two elephants staring me straight in the face.
What, right up at the window?
Right behind the car, because they're actually pushing it forward to get us out of the bog. They weren't wild elephants, they were kunkis, and these are the domestic elephants they used to help reduce the conflict. So, of course, there was a couple of men on the back of each elephant, but I didn't see them initially. I just saw these two elephants, and I thought, this is it, my number's up. You know, I've had a good life so far, so I should just be happy about this.
It's the scene in Jurassic Park with the T-Rex, from your point of view.
Yeah.
but in fact, they were there to help.
They were there to help. They pushed us out, absolutely. They got us out of the bog, so we just had to wait for them to do that. It was fantastic. But luckily, that wasn't the end of my days. I'd only been married about a week at that stage, so my husband was pleased to see me get home at the end of it.
You were speaking to ministers in India and public officials about the African solutions to human-elephant conflict, using these chili bricks or moving the water holes and the like. How responsive were Indian public officials to these ideas that the Africans have developed?
Well, the minister that I spoke to, the state minister for the environment there, he was actually very responsive. He really liked the idea, and he encouraged WWF staff and other organisations to try it out. So actually they did go out after that and try the chili program. Worked in some areas, didn't work in others, but it did seem to have some deterrent value in India as well. But in general, it is tough in India.
Was there resistance for a you're not patently not Indian?
Yeah.
So was there resistance for someone outsider like you coming in and offering solutions to what's going on in their villages?
Absolutely, and that is an ongoing challenge. I think, you know, the fact that these ideas are coming out of Africa, and we don't tend to look to Africa for solutions generally. You know, Africa's always looked on as a bit of a failure, which in conservation it really isn't. Actually,
yes, we go to Africa to give them solutions.
Exactly.
That's the the cliche there, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Isn't it? And actually, in India, I think there was a lot of resistance to the fact that I was female, that I was from, not from there. That it really took a lot to get over that. But it's, you know, we made a bit of progress there, and it's ongoing, and hopefully it will continue.
You became pregnant quite easily. Then you wrote, very sadly, you miscarried, but quite early into the pregnancy. And just when you were gearing up for big change, it's, you know, it's happening, and then suddenly it's not happening. Yeah. And that must have been quite bewildering for you.
It was, but, you know, it's the whole thing. It absolutely was. It was tough, but thankfully, very early on for me. And very soon after, we were lucky to fall pregnant again with our son Solo, who's now 3 and a half, and he's keeping us on our toes. And he's, you know, fantastic little guy. He's been to Africa 3 times since he was born. He's been to Borneo, Sri Lanka. He's met the president in Sri Lanka. I mean, he's had the most extraordinary life so far, and he's probably not going to remember a thing about it. But we've got the photos.
You went back to Zimbabwe in 2011, a couple of years ago, now with a husband and a son, and you hadn't been there for, I think, 10 years or so, to Humani, the game park where you'd had been there. What had changed after all those years, those kind of 10 years of chaos under Mugabe, where years of hyperinflation, land evacuations, all of those things?
And the chaos continues, unfortunately. We saw the election last week. It was heartrending to go back there after so long. It had been about 11 years. I'd left in 2000 in a hell of a rush and moved to Namibia to work on black-faced impala. And it was a lot of things were familiar, you know, driving over the old river bed where I'd driven over a million times, the old safari camps that were still there. But of course, you know, two of their 4 safari camps were no longer running because they'd had no tourism for over a decade. And they really struggle. They're struggling to get any sort of income. I've just come back from there. I was there a week ago as well, following up. And I think people in Zimbabwe are really tired of all this nonsense. They just want to move on. They want to get on with their lives. And I think it's extraordinary that people like Roger and Ann Whittle have soldiered on throughout the dark days. There was times where, you know, they were bartering for food. That's what I was told. There was no food on the shelves. There was not a car on the road because there was no petrol. By 2011, things were starting to look up again. But before that, I think probably some of the worst times were the few years before that.
How did the collapse of, you know, political authority and the economy in Zimbabwe affect poaching in Zimbabwe? Because poaching was a problem with elephant tusks, you know, of ivory. It was a problem we thought we'd solved, wasn't it, in 89 with that international banning of the trade in ivory. How does the collapse of Zimbabwe affected that?
Well, it's just made the poaching worse by a long way. That really is the big issue for wildlife. I mean, basically, in the Savi Valley Conservancy, where the Whittles are, people were stealing the fence that they'd built up around the conservancy to make snares. So, in tough political times, people get poorer and poorer, and we know Zimbabwe's really struggled with that. There's been droughts and famines there as well, compounding the political stuff. So people will do anything. So, of course, they're going to go to wherever they can get some fresh meat. So we saw a lot more poaching for meat species. But during this time as well, that's when we saw the illegal rhino poaching really escalate. And that was the biggest revelation for me in 2011, going back there, was just how serious that rhino poaching had become. Because there was a long time, actually, in southern Africa where rhino populations were building up. They were doing really well, And we stopped worrying about them. Well, people like me weren't so worried about rhinos and elephants in southern Africa anyway, because since that ban was put into place that you mentioned in 1989, that was for ivory specifically, but the same sort of idea came in for rhinos as well. It slowed the poaching down. But there's been this new resurgence of poaching, and it's caused by new markets that have emerged due to rising wealth in Asia.
It's driven. It's something you say it's driven by two factors. One is African poverty and Asian prosperity.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a great contrast there, isn't there? Because the guys in Africa are desperate. And, you know, for them, if they get a little bit of money to poach an elephant or a rhino, to us it's a little bit of money. To them, it's a fortune. It's years' worth of survival money. It can put their kids through school. You know, they can get their wife another house. They can feed their family with it. In Asia, it's the opposite. It's a very small minority of people that are buying this stuff, particularly the rhino horn. It's an elite minority, government officials, very rich business people, and they're the ones driving the trade from the other end. And if that wasn't happening, the poaching wouldn't be happening at all.
How valuable is the powder made from rhino horn.
I've heard mixed reports, and I believe that it's more than $65,000 a kilogram now. So, you know, one rhino horn could be a couple of kilograms. You can imagine what one horn is worth on the black market in Asia or Vietnam. Really, that's where most of the rhino horn is going.
That's more than cocaine.
Yeah, it's worth more than gold. It's you know, it's one of the most valuable commodities on the earth. I mean, the wildlife trade industry globally is the fourth largest trading industry in the world. You know, it's after things like drugs and you know, slave trade, that sort of thing. It's still, it's right up there. It's a billion-dollar industry.
You'd set up your own charity at that point, a smaller charity which you could run yourself, which was mainly dealing with elephant issues. That's when you decided to broaden your focus a little bit there into the rhino horn trade as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, after 3 years of co-running Animal Works, a small charity here in Australia, and raising funds for human-elephant conflict, and then, you know, going back to Zimbabwe, seeing how serious that problem was, I kind of realised that the battle for rhinos and for elephants cannot be won in Africa alone, that the war will be won in Asia by stopping the demand. And then just by pure coincidence to some extent, Andy, my husband, moved the Global Earth Hour team from Sydney to Singapore. So I ended up in Asia, which is where all of the rhino horn and the ivory is ending up. And that's when I got a chance to really try and find out what the hell is going on here. You know, why is this happening?
Well, let's start with talking about ivory. We know ivory is mainly used for jewellery, by and large. That drives a lot of the demand for the elephant tusk. What else are the tusks used for around Asia?
Yeah, jewellery is a large part of it. I was just in Bangkok a couple of weeks ago, and I could have bought a little carved ivory elephant for about $5. So tiny little thing that you can hang on a necklace. So that's about the cheapest thing you can get. The other extreme of that is you can buy the entire gleaming polished tusk itself for a lot more money, like for thousands and thousands of dollars. But very few people will be buying that. But a lot of it's used for art and carvings, that sort of thing. I mean, it's been treasured for a very long time in Asia. This is not a new thing. It's just that there's so many more people and so much more wealth in Asia now that it's starting to push the demand up.
How does an elephant tusk differ from a rhino horn? I mean, they're both horns on, you know, the front of the animal there. Are they similar things? Are they made of the same stuff or different stuff?
No, different stuff. So so ivory is more like teeth. It's dentine. Rhino horn is more like fingernails. So and it has the same medicinal effect as fingernails as well, which is, you know, according to Western medicine, absolutely nothing. According to traditional medicine, it's a different story. It's been used for a long time in traditional Chinese medicine to reduce fever, to reduce heat in the body, which is why it's now being put forward as a hangover cure, because it's all about showing off to your friends, you know, at parties. It's like having a sports car or, you know, having something that makes you look a Gucci bag or something like that, because it's so expensive. And if you're holding one of these drinking parties in Vietnam and you can offer your friends a little bit of this powder to put into your rice wine, you know, that's a real sign of status.
And, what a hangover cure. Yeah. A kind of anti-inflammatory hangover cure. That's what it's all. But that doesn't work, does it?
Well, even if it does, it's the same as Panadol. You can get it a lot cheaper, right? It's you know, and yeah, scientific. There's no scientific evidence to show that it works whatsoever. But traditional medicine does believe that it has an effect. But I guess the point is that we shouldn't be using this stuff at all. It's coming from a species that's going extinct. The challenge in Vietnam is that most of these people who are using it have never seen a rhino in the wild, and they don't feel in any way responsible for what's happening to rhinos in Africa. And Africa's miles away. It's irrelevant to them.
Is there an understanding that to harvest in ivory and rhino horn involves the death of the animal?
That's an interesting comment, because I've met taxi drivers and people in markets all over different parts of Asia and asked that question. And it's surprising how many people say to you, you don't have to kill the elephant to get the ivory, do you? You know, they just fall out like teeth. Isn't that how it happens? So there's a lot of misunderstanding and I think lack of awareness in Asia about, you know, the gruesome reality of what has to happen to these elephants and rhinos in order to get the horn and the ivory. You know, and I've seen some terrible footage of elephants and rhinos with their faces completely hacked off. I mean, to get the ivory and to get the rhino horn, you've got to hack the faces of these animals off. You've got to kill them first. Or, you know, there's been some terrible stories of rhinos and elephants both left half alive, you know. And, you know, when the conservationists come in afterwards, the anti-poaching teams, and they find this animal and it's you know, it's just a bloodied mess, but it's still breathing somehow. I mean, it's just torture on these species.
So there's nothing for it except to shoot the animal.
They're going to die anyway, so there's no alternative. And unfortunately, you know, the rate of poaching has increased hugely. For elephants, it's around about 30,000 a year that are being poached now in Africa. Last year, we saw over 600 rhinos killed in Africa. This year, it's going to be higher than that. It's probably going to be about 800. And the problem is that these populations haven't recovered from the poaching in the 70s and the 80s, so they built up a little bit. But now we're hammering them again.
In Bangkok, you went into a market there to see ivory on sale. Now, the trade in ivory is banned in Thailand officially, and yet it seems ivory objects are sold openly there.
Yeah.
Was there any concern about you showing up with a camera, taking pictures of these ivory little bits of jewellery?
Yeah, there was. And actually, I was back in there recently. I'm working on a project with an Asian television star, Nadia Hutagalong, who's a fantastic lady who's helping me raise awareness of this issue in Asia. And we were there with a small crew and just walking around Chatuchuk markets, which is one of the markets that a lot of Australian tourists will go to. So if you're an Australian ever visiting Thailand, keep an eye out and don't buy ivory. But, you know, we were in there with cameras, and at one stage, one seller did come up to us and asked to see why we were taking photographs and what we were filming, and he asked for us to delete some of those things. So, it didn't feel dicey in the same way that perhaps for me going into Vietnam alone as a woman on her own and pregnant slightly before that felt, asking questions about rhino horn, because in the rhino horn trade it's criminals. It is, you know, the absolute corruption. It's greed that's driving the industry. Ivory's not worth quite as much money. And in Thailand, actually, the people there love elephants. So I think we can have a win in Thailand, even though it's massively unregulated, the markets there at the moment. At least the Thai Prime Minister, Yingluck Shinawatra, has come out and said she's going to try and stop close the legal loopholes that cause the ivory to be sold.
When you talk about going to a market and seeing like a little amulet made out of ivory of an elephant, it kind of reminds me of those places where, you know, you go to a chicken fast food place and there's this kind of cartoony chicken who's really happy about you coming into, you know, it's a bit like that. Do the Thais actually see that connection? Because many Thais do revere the elephant.
Yeah.
And to see the connection, in order to make this little tribute to the elephant, an elephant has to be killed.
Yeah, I think they're starting to make the connection. I think since the CITES conference in April this year, when the Prime Minister came out and spoke publicly about it and said she respects elephants and all Thai people respect elephants, and you know we have to stop these illegal markets as a result that's causing the poaching in Africa. I think that's helped. There's been a lot of international publicity around it. Some of that's getting back to people. And in between, you know, I was in Bangkok 6 months prior to this recent trip, and I did feel that there was a change in the air with the sellers, that they were, you know, sort of suggesting that they might not be able to sell ivory for too much longer, some of them. And they were warning people that they can't take ivory back to their own country as well, which is quite interesting. They said to me that I could take ivory back to Singapore, but I couldn't take it to Australia. So there was a few warnings out there. But it's still openly available. There was just as much ivory available last month as there was 6 months ago, in spite of all the publicity and all the international meetings and the Prime Minister's statements. So we've got a long way to go to change this.
It's a little side story here. You went to Borneo to go and look at the pygmy elephants there, which are beautiful creatures, beautiful animals. Tell me where you actually found one, because it took a bit of finding, didn't it?
It did. It took us days and days. And I was there with my husband, Andy, and my son, Solo. And eventually I just said to the boys, I said, look, I'm going to have to go out and look for this on my own. And so I went out with the guide, and Andy stayed back at the camp where we were with Solo. And as soon as we got close to where we thought they might be, I was there with a guy that's been working on elephants for a long time. He knew them very well, young guy. And he said, look, he got off the boat, and then immediately there was this moment where he just heard something crashing through the forest, and he jumped back onto the boat. He said, right, it's here. So, okay, off I jumped. And I didn't even think about what I was walking into, of course. You know, Borneo pygmy elephants, how big are they really? Well, it turns out they're actually bigger than your knee. They don't kick you in the knee, as my husband likes to tell that joke. They are quite large, actually.
Like how big?
Well, they're a couple of metres tall, actually. They're quite a lot smaller than African elephants.
It's a pretty big pygmy, isn't it?
That... they're not that pygmy, actually, and they don't like it when you call them pygmy either. They've got a touch of what you might call small man syndrome. And this elephant, we got very, very close to it, and Suleiman, my guide, he was saying to me, look, the elephant's only, it's right there, it's right
there.
What
was it doing?
I think it was just watching us, actually, but it was such thick jungle. You know, this habitat in Borneo is just thick, thick, thick jungle.
And when you're that close to an elephant, sorry, I just have to ask you about this, because getting that close to an elephant in the wild is kind of extraordinary. Do they smell? Can you?
Yeah. Yeah, they do smell sort of like, you can smell the dung all around, you know, that composting elephant and vegetable type smell. But the jungle there smells, it's dense and it's wet, and there's little flies coming up everywhere, and there's this drone, this insane drone of cicadas. You just, you know, if you spent too long in that jungle, you would actually go insane, I think. But being 5 metres away from an elephant, I never used to get that close to elephants in the wild in Africa. I always gave them a healthy distance, but you don't need to get that close in Africa because it's much more open habitat. So I didn't realise just how close to this elephant I was. And Suleiman was pointing at this elephant, and I couldn't see it all. And I had my big zoom on my camera, and it's zooming in and out, trying to focus on this elephant. I'm trying to find it with the naked eye, still can't see it. And then suddenly, it didn't wait for me to see it. It came for us.
How close was it to you?
It was about 5 metres away when it charged. And I did what any clear-thinking human being does at that point, and I ran for my life. And I didn't look back. And I say that I was, when I think about that moment, I don't know how long it went, because adrenaline just surges through your veins.
And what kind of noise did the elephant make as it charged?
It screamed.
They screamed? Yeah. Elephants scream?
When it's charging, absolutely.
What like a honk? Or is it some other kind of a noise? Oh, is it like a trumpet blast? Or
It's a... ear-piercing, it's a scream, Richard. I don't know how else to describe it. It's like, that's the best I can do. And if you want to hear the real thing, it's on my website, on my video, because I forgot to turn off my video camera, and it was still running, because you're not thinking about switching buttons off when you're getting charged. You're just running, and you can hear on this the audio of this video of me just running through the bush and panting and going,
being chased by a very big pygmy elephant.
But thankfully, I wasn't being chased, but I didn't know that Suleiman had stood up to this bull, and incredible bravery, this young man. He'd stood up and clapped and yelled, and this elephant must have been 2 or 3 metres away from him, and he stood his ground, and the elephant backed off.
You can do that to a pygmy elephant? You can intimidate it?
Apparently you can.
How brave is Suleiman then?
Incredible, yeah. Very brave man, and probably saved my life that day, because I was still running when he caught up to me.
In a way, the saddest and most grim part of your book is when you go to Vietnam, to Hanoi, to Lanong Street, where a lot of traditional Chinese medicines are sold there. Tell me what you saw as you went into the market there.
Well, you can pretty much buy anything you want in Lanong Street, you know, from seahorses to geckos. There's all sorts of boxes that have pictures of tigers and lions on the front, which are, you know, associated with that if you buy that product, it'll give you the powers that the animal has. So, you know, traditional medicine is still really big in Vietnam. And interestingly, the hospitals there have traditional medicine and Western medicine in the same hospital. So people use both all the time. And people didn't want to talk to me, I'll be honest. I was there, I think, earlier this year, and I was asking questions about a substance that is illegal, rhino horn. And it's not everyday people that are using this stuff, because they can't afford it. It's the super rich. They're the ones using it at these drinking parties. But the other people that are using it or are trying to get a hold of it are parents of children or people that are dying of cancer.
Now, why are they trying to procure rhino horn for a cancer treatment? Who has told them that this is a treatment for cancer?
Well, criminals. The people that are trying to make money out of this rhino horn, because it is so valuable, are telling them that it will cure cancer, and it doesn't. And even traditional medicine doctors that I spoke to said, it doesn't cure cancer. We don't even say that it cures cancer. What it can do in traditional medicine is help you with some of the symptoms, to help you live with cancer if you've got it, but it's not going to cure you. But of course, the women that I spoke to, and the fathers as well of these kids...
This was in a children's hospital, you went to.
In a really heartbreaking situation with children that are dying of cancer in a hospital in Hanoi. And I was there with some experts from TRAFFIC, the Global Wildlife Trade Organization, and just asking people, you know, if you could get a hold of rhino horn, would you buy it? Have you tried it? Do you believe it works? And it was interesting, pretty much all those mothers said, yeah, of course I'd try it if it works. Does it work? Does it work like people say it works? Where can I get it? And of course you would, because if your child's dying of cancer, you'll try anything.
But when they asked you, does it work? Mm. What did you say?
Well, I had to say, no, it doesn't. And that was, I guess, one of the worst things as well, is because it almost by us being there asking the questions, we were building on this whole false hope that these criminals have instilled in Vietnam.
Did they ask you why you were asking those questions then? Why would you come into a hospital and say, have you been offered rhino horn powder? Do you think it works? And then telling them it doesn't work. Did they want to know why you were asking these questions?
Yeah, they did. Only one lady came out afterwards. She followed us and she said, you know, yeah, why are you asking these questions exactly? And it was heartbreaking to say to her, look, I'm sorry, it doesn't work. This is, you know, we're with TRAFFIC, the Global Wildlife Trade Organization, and we're trying to stop people being told this myth that it doesn't work. But I did meet some people that had tried it over there as well. But even the guys that had tried it said that they thought that their friends were only using it because, they wanted to look the part as opposed to the actual medicinal use of it. Because, of course, you can use a Panadol or an aspirin or something much, much cheaper. It's not really about the health benefit when it comes to rhino horn. It's about the status.
So primarily then, the rhino is dying out because people believe, one, it can cure their hangover, and two, it might cure cancer, then, essentially, in countries. And of course it doesn't either.
No, it doesn't. And it's devastating. The results we're seeing from that are just, you know, we've got to do something to intervene. And I think really the only solution for both elephants and rhinos is to stop the demand in Asia. So that's what I'm working on now.
Well, there was demand in Japan for many, many years for ivory, for example. It's not there anymore. Is that a case study you can use?
Yes, and we did learn a lot from the 1980s, and they had very successful advertising campaigns in the 1980s that led to the international ban, because we have been here before with poaching. In fact, the poaching was much more severe during that period. In the 1980s, we were losing 100,000 elephants a year to poachers. But those countries that were buying the ivory in those years, and also the rhino horn, were much wealthier in those days. We saw their economies lose some of that wealth, and now there's new wealth in China, in Thailand, in Vietnam, and in most of Asia. This is the growth area. So, I mean, perhaps there's some hope from the point of view that these economies won't be growing forever. But in the meantime, we can do a lot just by educating the population, by letting them know that you have to kill the elephants and the rhinos to get these products.
Another aspect of the story, it's one of the great untold stories, it just doesn't get reported in media here, is the huge amount of Chinese investment in Africa at the moment that's going on. And Chinatowns are being established in places like very unlikely places, you would think, like Khartoum, although Chinatowns, of course, are everywhere in the world, so it isn't really that unlikely at all. Is that having an effect on the trade? Is there, because of that closer connection, direct connection between China and Africa, is that doing something to accelerate the trade in both ivory and rhino horn?
Oh, unquestionably. That's a very large part of it. There's a lot more Asian residents, largely Chinese, living in Africa today, so it's easier to get the ivory and the rhino horn out. You know, just being in Zimbabwe the week before last, we drove past a fire truck, a fire engine, and it had writing in Mandarin. And then in Nairobi, not long before that, in April, you see all the road workers and the Chinese companies that are building all the new roads in Nairobi and across Kenya, and there's Chinese bosses leading very large teams of Africans building the roads. So I've really seen a lot of changes in Africa in terms of sort of the shift, and it's a good thing in many ways, because this Asian money is helping develop and build up Africa, which is what it really needs to cope with these problems. But at the other end of the spectrum, you've got this massive trade in rhino horn and ivory, which is definitely being fueled by the large Asian population that's there.
So given what you now know, is the future thrust of your work going to be in Asia rather than Africa?
Well, that's really where the problems for Africa are being caused by in terms of the conservation issues. Yeah, so I think I'll be there for a while yet, and I don't think the illegal trade is going to slow down at all until we start really making some headway in changing the way people think. But I'm very, very hopeful about it, though, Richard. I really think we can make a difference. I know people get very overwhelmed by the enormity of this, and they say, well, you know, this rhino horn's been used for thousands of years. How are you going to change the mentality? But I've spoken to people in Vietnam and in Thailand about this, and I realise there's a lot of ignorance out there. We can go a very long way just by getting the message out there in the right way. And it can't just be us Westerners coming in, which is why I'm working with Nadia Hutigalong as an Asian celebrity. It has to come from within these countries themselves.
Just very briefly, are you putting yourself at some personal risk here? I mean, you're threatening to interrupt the revenue stream of large organised crime cartels here.
Yes. Should I be worried?
I don't know. Maybe you should. Maybe you shouldn't. I don't know. I don't really know. But it's fantastic hearing your story and finding out the truth about what's been going on. Because this is a story that bewilders so many people, I think. You go, why? Why would anyone want powdered rhino horn? Now yeah. we kind of understand. And it's been fascinating speaking with you, Tammy. And look, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
And Tammy Matson has a website if you want to find out more information, which is directed towards her charity. It's Tammy, spelled TammieMatson.com, TammyMatson.com. And her book is called Planet Elephants.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.